class, but they want to walk in the grab.
So I would hope that usually, like you said, should we just take a look?
I love my life. If I weren't here today, I'd be able to study. So this is regional, it's kind of like Salsas or?
Good morning, why don't we get started? I'm Kathleen Bethel, African American Studies Librarian at Northwestern University Library and a supporter of East Chicago over the years. And I'm pleased to be here today and to introduce our panel and to act as a stopwatch for the program and to be sure that there's time for you to engage in the conversation about local history and East Chicago. So I'm welcoming from Media Burn Archive, Sarah Chapman. Is Sarah not here yet?
No, I'm
here. Oh, I'm sorry, okay. Empty chair, it's Noah walking around. My apologies. Sarah Chapman with Media Burn Archive. Karen Kanemoto, the Japanese American Service Committee. Noah Lindstrom.
Who's wandering
around. Rebecca Sanders from the Chicago Cultural Alliance, and they also brought nice handouts and brochures, so be sure not to leave without them. We wouldn't want to send them home with their supplies. And why don't we just get started as we're listed on the program with Sarah first, then Karen, then Noah and Rebecca, and then you. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sarah Chapman, and I'm the executive director of the Media Burn Independent Video Archive. We're in the northwest side of Chicago in Old Irving Park. And we've collected over 6,000 documentary videotapes produced by independent videographers outside of corporate contexts. The tapes chronicle four decades of American life, including politics, arts and culture, community life, urban issues, ethnic identities, and more. Our mission is to preserve audiovisual records of history and culture for future generations and to make them available for educational and scholarly use via the internet. The collection features the work of hundreds of different video makers from around the world, produced over the last four decades, but the heart of the collection is Chicago. And so I guess you can move to the next slide.
Sure.
Okay. The majority of the collection has a connection to Chicago people, places, politics, and history. It includes portraits of life in neighborhoods across the city, from Roseland to Rogers Park. It includes the largest collection of anywhere, a video featuring Studs Terkel, many of them donated from his personal collection. It also features an incredible documentation of Chicago politics, from the day-to-day business of the precinct captain to documenting every mayor since Richard J. Daley. Actually, not Eugene Sawyer, kind of lying about that, but every mayor except that. So the national significance of the collection was recognized this year by the Federal Save America's Treasures Program, administered by the National Endowment for the Humanities, which provides funding for the protection of our nation's endangered and irreplaceable cultural heritage. Next slide. Nearly 200 hours of camera original videotapes documenting the 1992 election were selected to be preserved as part of the program. And these are stills from that collection. The tapes feature unseen documentary footage of the Clinton strategic team, who have since become major political players, including James Carville, Rahm Emanuel, Dede Meyers, George Stephanopoulos, and David Wilhelm. They also document Carol Moseley Braun's historic Senate campaign. We're going to be spending the next year restoring and transferring these tapes so that they're available online. Next slide. So this is a picture of some of the shelves in our office to show you the nuts and bolts of what we do. Videotape is a very short lifespan, limited to a few decades at most. So our work involves the urgent necessity to transfer the footage contained on these deteriorating and obsolete videotape formats before they're lost for good. We've been digitizing our collection for about 6 years now and have completed about a quarter of our collection. To reach the broadest audiences possible, we make all digitized videos available online. Our website, mediaburn.org, currently streams about 1,500 hours of archival video, and that number is constantly increasing as we continue to process our collection. Next slide. MediaBurn was always intended to be a specifically online archive. We were founded in 2003 because it finally seemed that the technology was there to allow the videos in our collection to reach a global audience through the internet. So while we began cataloging and preserving our collection, we also began building our streaming video website. MediaBurn.org was launched in 2006. It's a fantastic free tool for researchers, educators, students, community groups, and the general public to access primary sources for history and culture. Next slide. It was important to us when creating this online space for research that we provide as much historical detail and textual information as possible. So each tape is accompanied by an introductory description with historical information, plus a minute-by-minute log listing all the people and places, a summary of the action, and important quotes. This helps viewers find the exact footage they're looking for, and information in the log shows up in Google search results. Next slide. We also scan and digitize relevant archival documents that shed light on contemporaneous events, program reception, production details, history of public screenings, and other historically relevant information. Being an online archive has allowed us to reach millions of people around the world, literally from almost every country, who never would have been able to visit our archive on the northwest side of Chicago. It also means that our roles as curators of our own material are a bit different than in the past. An online archive is always in a state of flux, changing as we add more information, and also changing as our users add more information. The collection is continually enriched by the submission of historical information from observers, creators, and participants of the events documented in our collection. Our archive in particular, since it covers the last few decades of American life, has plenty of room for enrichment through the memories of people still living. We're all very familiar at this point with the standard ways in which users can interact with online content, such as the brief comments users can add to blog posts or videos, but there's room also for substantive and academic interaction. There's a really exciting opportunity for users to improve our catalog records by adding information or including their own archival objects. Next slide. One more interesting and valuable example of this kind of important and productive feedback occurred with a recently restored reel-to-reel videotape shot in 1969, depicting performances by countercultural artist and musician Thule Kupferberg. In winter 2010, one of Kupferberg's close friends showed him the video on our website and watched it with him and interviewed him about it. She then provided MediaBurn with a written oral history describing the performances on the tape in great detail, including the names of the people that appeared on screen, the evolution of the performances as Kupferberg performed them before and after this taping, and so on. We were extremely lucky to have received this input from Kupferberg only a few months before his death in July 2010. Without this firsthand knowledge, we'd have never been able to discover all that information about this tape. The other new aspect of being an online archive is the necessity to use as many different platforms as possible to show your work. Originally, we assumed that we would create a website, and that would be the way people would see our videos. And while our website is an extremely important part of the way we fulfill our mission, it's even more important that we participate in as many different social networking and other websites as possible. Next slide. We also post videos on YouTube, the Internet Archive, WordPress, Vimeo, Reframe, and do outreach through Facebook and Twitter. Through a combination of these tools, MediaBurn videos have achieved nearly 8 million views in the past 4 years, which is a remarkable result for historical content. These outside tools are an extremely important part of the way audiences find our videos. Whenever one of our videos is seen by a large number of people, it's usually because a group with a certain interest, something obscure like old arcade games or fans of a specific baseball player or whatever, find the video and spread it through their online communities. The vast majority of the population doesn't spend their time visiting archives and watching archival videos. It's just not really like something that occurs to them, but this means that curation and the use of outside channels is crucial to reaching audiences and convincing them that this content is relevant to them. It's not really important that the material always be presented in the context of the MediaBurn collection and vision, that people first go to our homepage, learn what we're about, and then start browsing our collection generally. What's more important is that people find the work that's relevant to them and make it part of their communities. So in addition to presenting 1,500 hours of full-length archival video on our website, we also curate short videos that relate to current events or topics that we think people might be interested in, and we send those out into the world to be embedded in blogs and linked to on Facebook or discussed in forums or whatever ways people choose to interact. It's important to be as broad as possible because audiences have their own preferred ways of interacting with online content, and ultimately, it's getting the content out there that matters, not the channel. Now I'll talk a little bit about our future goals. At this point, some aspects of MediaBurn.org are outdated, mainly because we built our site before online video was common, before YouTube was built, and at the time, the focus was on decreasing required bandwidth and any other barriers to use. Now these concerns are not really as present, and there are many features that no one had really thought of in 2005 that have just become standard parts of the online experience, such as the ability to embed videos in other sites, an emphasis on related videos, and other things like that. So what we would love to do is make our site more compatible with other widely used online tools and make it easier for users to share and interact with our content, to really decrease the technological distinction between our content at MediaBurn.org and the other lives of our content on other sites. A major priority is the creation of tools that make it even easier for users to provide information about our content, such as annotation or submission of related videos or documents. We would love to make our site easier to use, both in and outside the classroom, such as including tools for teachers to download and edit video compilations for classroom use, because it's important to make it easy for them to use the materials even in schools where internet or computer access is spotty. We also want to optimize the site to work on mobile devices, which are clearly becoming a primary way we all access the internet. We will continue to emphasize the value of full-length descriptions and historical information that make our site an important site for research. So this is one of the main reasons why it's important for us to have our own website at all. For users who do want to go in depth, the videos need to be continue to be presented within a larger framework of history and analysis in a way that commercial sites do not. We will also continue to focus on the portion of curation. While some may think that the internet has decreased the need for the people who have traditionally guided users through collections and content, such as librarians, archivists, TV producers, art curators, in our experience, the need for these guides is even higher now. The videos in our collection that have not been featured in some way, like on our blog or on YouTube or whatever, have probably been seen only a handful of times, whereas the videos that we do highlight often find much larger or more dedicated audiences than we could have ever imagined. Technology may be changing the role of the archive, but ultimately our job will continue to be about finding new methods and new tools to guide users through collections so they can make them their own.
So I am Karen Kanemoto, and I am manager of the Legacy Center at the Japanese American Service Committee. So what is the Legacy Center, and what is the Japanese American Service Committee? And to explain that, I have to kind of back into some prehistory. So for those of you who are familiar with the story, I apologize. The Japanese American community in Chicago is largely a byproduct of World War II. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941, almost immediately FBI agents swept up Japanese men from their homes in the state of Washington, Oregon, California, and disappeared them for a couple of years. They placed them in prison camps, and their families largely did not see them for at least 2 years. Then, in February 1942, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, which said the military is entrusted to do whatever it needs to do to ensure national security. And then what happened was that about 110,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans were removed from their homes in the military zones of the states I just mentioned, placed in internment camps in desolate areas of California, Colorado, Idaho, Wyoming, Utah, Arizona, and Arkansas. So, gradually and on a case-by-case basis, they were allowed to leave the camps to go to school, to go to work, but they could not go home. They could not go home to the West Coast until 1945, so many came to Chicago. Why Chicago? Chicago had lots of schools, lots of jobs in a whole different bunch of areas, and they had lots of jobs in which you did not have to speak English. Moreover, Chicago did not have the sort of pervasive anti-Asian bias that was prevalent all up and down the coast. And just to illustrate this, my father-in-law comes to Chicago. He gets off the train, he steps out into the street, and his hat blows off. And a Chicago cop retrieves his hat, brings it back to him, and says, "Be careful, sir." And my father-in-law was just dumbfounded. This is something that would never, ever, ever happen on the West Coast. So, in the census of 1940, Chicago had about 390 Japanese residents, and most were Japanese because Japanese were not allowed to be naturalized citizens until 1952. So there were about 390 existing Japanese residents of Chicago. By 48, there were more than 20,000. So this is a 5,000% increase in the Japanese and Japanese American population in Chicago. So in the midst of that, the JASC, the Japanese American Service Committee, which was originally known as the Chicago Resettlers Committee, was born. And it was originally organized to connect these new arrivals, these 20,000 new arrivals with city services, and just to get them acclimated to the community, to help them find jobs, help them find housing, you know, help them find a church, things like that. They provided activities for the older non-English speaking resettlers, and tried to provide healthful activities for the teens to keep them from raising mischief. So, and also, all along, they provided counseling in one form or another. And you have to acknowledge the idea of culture shock. A lot of these people, as I mentioned a couple times, were not English speaking. A lot of them had never lived in a large city. They had all suffered discrimination because of their race. And they had all spent months and years in seclusion. So the Chicago Resettlers Committee served various waves of new arrivals, including the Japanese American veterans, the Japanese Americans who had been caught in Japan during the war years and were only in the late 40s allowed to come back to the States, Japanese Hawaiians who came to Chicago to find job opportunities, to go to school, and then the so-called Japanese war brides. So until the mid-50s, the Resettlers Committee occupied itself with its original activities. And at that time, in the mid-50s, the organization renamed itself the Japanese American Service Committee and turned its focus into providing care for the elderly in the community. So in the 90s, which is a big leap, but in the 90s, the Japanese American Service Committee was associated with a young archival student who recognized what exactly the organization represented to the city and to the community. and she proposed to consolidate and catalog the JSC's library and organizational files. And it also, the Legacy Center Archives and Library also expanded its reach to become a repository for papers, photos, memorabilia, and objects donated by members of the community. And undoubtedly, it was because of the fact that it is the JSC and was so known in the community that members of the community trusted the Legacy Center with their treasures. The JSC has drawn on the Legacy Center to compile two interpretive exhibits, and I have an example of one over here. This is a panel from our 60th anniversary exhibit, Origins of Now, and most of the photos there are from our collection. Sarah mentioned collecting things before they're lost forever. Well, these photos were the work of a man who lived in a retirement home. His wife was in a nursing home. He died when our homemakers went to clean out his apartment. They came upon boxes and boxes and boxes of photos and negatives, all of excellent quality. And this is one of the jewels of our collections now. The second interpretive exhibit is called Winning the Peace. It's the story of the Military Intelligence Service in World War II. These are the Japanese language specialists who served as interpreters, translators, and interrogators during and after World War II. The Legacy Center is also involved in a video interview project involving the Nisei generation, that is, the Niseis being the children of the immigrants from Japan. Now, the Niseis who were teenagers during the evacuation and internment years during World War II are now in their 80s, so there's a certain urgency to this project. So, why haven't we heard more about the Legacy Center? And the answer would be access. I'm a little embarrassed to be addressing this crowd because really we have very little online at this time. We do have some brief descriptions of some of our collections online. We do not have any finding aids online. But I think we have a plan. Last year we had an assessment performed by a consulting archivist who was funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. She identified the strengths and weaknesses of the collection pretty much showed us how we have to go forward. Now, in the coming months, we are pursuing funding for a project archivist to catalog everything, to help prepare finding aids for everything. We are pursuing funding for hardware and software to catalog the collection and to be able to mount those finding aids online. And of course, one of our largest problems is the fact that the JSC itself, all of the JSC, the social services as well as the Legacy Center, are housed in an older, repurposed factory building, not the greatest place for archival collections. So we hope to someday move the collections into a freestanding location, which is safe, temperature and humidity, and where we can have everything together. So, why should anybody care about the JSC Legacy Center? Well, for those of us who are Japanese Americans, it helps remind us who we are. For those of us who are not Japanese Americans, I think that the collection helps to remind everybody that we can, as a people, we can examine our past, and I hope we can learn from it. So that is all, and thank you for your attention.
PDF. I'm going to just make it full screen. Hello, well, Colin, switching presentations. I just wanted to thank Karen again for coming and speaking to us. One of the things that's really interesting to me is looking at local history and community archives, and there's some early adopters with technology, but there's also a definite digital divide, and I think there's opportunities for people to work together so that everyone's history can be shared online. And I'm going to be talking in particular about a project in Champaign-Urbana, but I'm going to try to not focus too much on the details, but more on some of the implications that may be relevant for people up here in Chicago. And this project is called eBlackCU. It's a collaborative portal on African American history and culture in Champaign-Urbana that grew out of a number of different physical collections in local libraries, archives, museums, and has grown to include materials from people's personal, private collections that they wanted to keep in their family, but they were more than happy to share online and really welcome the opportunity of having that material be made available online so that they could send it to relatives in other parts of the country. So can you go to the next slide? So one of the contexts of this project is just I've been really interested in this genealogy movement around technology. Some studies have showed that 50 to 90% of the users of archives now are genealogists. And FamilySearch.com, which is run by the Mormon Church, has more than 100,000 volunteers indexing records every day online. So this is enormous amount of the population that's really mobilizing to use technology around what amounts to really local history, because I see family history and local history as really one and the same in a lot of different respects. But there's also press the down arrow. But we also have to, we have to be serious and recognize that not everyone is online and not everyone's participating, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And we call this the digital inequalities. 64% of Americans have broadband at home, but only 49% African American, and only 33% urban African American with less than 25,000 income. So there's a 10 to 20 percentage point difference in access to broadband, and that has implications for who has access to digital tools to find themselves online. And so in Champaign-Urbana, we received, the cities and the university received funding to build a big broadband network, really in the historically African American communities, the north end of the city, which has been the historical center of the African-American community in Champaign-Urbana. And really as a result of surveys that showed that there was a stark digital divide in the local city. And with the eBlack Champaign-Urbana project, we thought to explicitly connect up local history and digital technology to the construction of high-speed broadband infrastructure. And this is just a show. This is African-Americans by Census Tract, and you can kind of see that there's a close correlation between African American population and the underserved areas of the two cities in terms of broadband availability and access. And this is just one more slide just to show that the African American community has existed since the 1850s, and it's grown both in terms of percentage and in absolute numbers throughout the last century and a half to currently being about 17% of the local population in Champaign-Urbana. And this is just a conceptual model of our project. Really, we started with the history, the historical community, And we have these things, cultural memory organizations, libraries, archives, museums, genealogical societies, the way that the community organizes around local history. And then we have the local African-American community itself. And now we have our digital library project, as well as this broadband infrastructure development. And we're looking at how this can both contribute to digital community memory, as well as what we're calling community cyber power, or the community able and to use digital technologies for self-determination. So just a quick overview of the portal itself, and just in the space of about over 1 year, we've managed to digitize and make available online over 40,000 pages and 6 days of audio and video. It's all publicly accessible, and anyone can contribute, including you. And one of the things that we found is that, I'll talk about this a little bit later, but in a town like Champaign-Urbana, there's a lot of connections to a lot of other places, Chicago, other communities across Illinois, and some of the people who've most eagerly taken advantage of the site have been people who grew up in Champaign-Urbana, who no longer live there, but want to use technology to stay connected to their home. So just skip this, go to the next one. This is just a screenshot of the site. I encourage you to, go to the next one. And this is another one. We have, in addition to text, we have streaming video on the site. And we used a program called Omeka, which is an open source software developed by the George Mason University Center for History and New Media. So this is completely a free software. We try to use as much as possible free tools. So the only software that we had to purchase was Adobe Acrobat Pro. Everything else was completely free software that's accessible to everyone. And we're working right now on a guide that would make it transparent about if someone was interested in doing something like this, what it would take. We don't have specialized equipment. We're just using standards Windows operating system. We're not using any fancy operating system. It's all open source. And for the most part, except for a few rare exceptions, requires no actual manipulation of raw code. It's all graphical interfaces. And this is just, in addition to putting the history online, we're also interested in archiving the present. And we've held a series of public forums about community technology in Champaign-Urbana, much like this East Chicago event. And that those videos from those forums are also available online. So this is just some screenshots of the head of the Unemployment Center and the local Bethel AME Church talking about technology and its importance for the community. And a big project that we've done, Gamma Upsilon Psi, which is a community organization, has done a debutante ball for African American women since 1972, and they put big yearbooks every year about these balls where people buy ads to help pool their resources to put young African American women into college. So these yearbooks are really treasures that have really touch everyone, and we've digitized all but three of the volumes, and We have them all available online, and we're creating indexes to these yearbooks so that people can search by name, which is really essential for family history. But this is all, for the most part, most of the energy we did get some small significant financial support from our Office of Vice Chancellor for Public Engagement, but a lot of the actual construction really relies on the goodwill of people both on campus and off campus, and people's volunteer energies and willingness to temporarily donate what to them are really precious treasures. So that requires a great deal of trust. But one of the things that's really interesting is, and we didn't really know we were going to find this, but in the process of trying to do this comprehensive mapping of information about the African American community, we really found that the University of Illinois is the elephant in the room. This is just an entity responsible for creating the content, and the University of Illinois is the largest entity, and this is in theses, dissertations, articles. There's absolutely no shortage of research projects in a town like Champaign-Urbana that have done things about the African American community. And so one of the big things that we're still trying to put our minds around is how we can we can at least make all this information accessible so that there's a, because that's never been done before. And I think if Champaign-Urbana is one of those communities that you kind of know, like, there's been no shortage of research done there, but there's often not a clear trail of documentation showing what happened and why it mattered and why the research was necessary to happen in the first place. So that was something that kind of grew out of the process of making the portal that we didn't know at the beginning was going to happen, but as we got more into thinking about the entire corpus of documentation about this community, kind of grew out of the process of building the library. You can just skip that and we also hired with this financial support, we were able to hire seven local people, local youth, from African American youth from the high schools and the local community college, to work with us over the summer to learn really all the different steps that went into building something like this, in terms of web design, interviews for oral history, contacting people to set up oral histories, organizing events, making posters, and just everything that really is necessary to do something like this. We tried to ground them as comprehensively as possible into what it takes to do something like this. And this is just we did at North First Street, which is one of the historical African American business districts. They advertised and made the posters for an oral history day where a lot of the old timers in the community really came out and really enjoyed being able to see some of the photographs from their history and also share their memory. So we try to also combine digital technology and just physical space and see how we can just use whatever resources available to make an impact. And this is just this is Rose and Taylor's Barbershop, also on North First Street. After we did this oral history day, we gave to them the posters that we made, and those posters continue to hang in their barbershop, just as a kind of a physical presence for this digital library. And this is just a photo of the what we call the E-Black CU spiders at the start of the last summer. And they also, the spiders and myself, made kind of a bibliography of some of the works that we printed out and we presented at the American History Teachers Collaborative, which is just a gathering of social science K-12 educators from East Central Illinois. Just another way, we really, in a nutshell, just to try to wrap up as much as possible. I mean, we tried to really just branch out in as many directions as we could in terms of gathering up as much as we could, and then we also tried to get that information out in as many ways as we could. And it wasn't always as organized as perhaps the Media Burn Archive sounds like they did it with a much more organized plan. We tried to just do it and try to be more experimental and trying to just get things out with YouTube and Facebook and in any way we could. But in a much more experimental fashion to try to see what was possible. And this is just a quote. We can skip that. This is just one of the interesting things. I'm just going to conclude with this about Facebook. One of the interesting things was when we really got into things, we saw that there was a lot of people in the community, especially middle-aged and older individuals, who were really using Facebook as a way to share information about family and local history. And this one woman, it's a really interesting anecdote and really telling, she found out some information in our library, independent of us, about her father, who was a pastor at a local church. And she contacted me because she wanted to share some of the material in her personal archives. And what she ended up doing was uploading that material to Facebook, and then she emailed me and said, "I uploaded it. You can download it now," and added the E-Black CU. So in other words, there's kind of I mean I thought that was great. That's beautiful. But one of the things that we have to think about is is that kind of a digital inequality? If someone's entire notion of the internet is Facebook, and that's kind of the start and the end, that to me is in a way a digital inequality, because that's kind of a limited sense of all the possibilities of what digital technology can be. And I see that as an opportunity or a teachable moment to try to broaden people's conceptions about open source technology and about because Facebook ultimately is a corporate platform, and they could theoretically pull the plug at any moment, and then where would all this be? But I don't think that's based on all the kind of ethnographic work we did on Facebook. That's not really part of the popular conception of what Facebook is. So that's kind of another thing that came out of this project as an experimental project, and we don't have the answers to what could be. I mean, but one of the things that we're trying to think about is what could be the response of the traditional cultural heritage institutions, libraries, archives, museums, to this really grassroots mobilization around Facebook as a way to share local history information. What are some of the avenues that the traditional cultural heritage institutions can use to both network in this new environment and also educate people about some of the limitations of Facebook and in a way to educate people in a way about the richness of the entirety of the internet, as opposed to just in some ways the limitations of something like Facebook. And I'm just going to, I have much more that I could say about this project, but just in the interest of time, I'm just going to leave you with that question. And I'm happy to talk more about this project. And there's also an enormous amount of documentation on the eBlackCU website that you're welcome to look through for more information about what we're trying to do.
Everybody. I'm Rebecca Sanders. I'm the Executive Director of the Chicago Cultural Alliance, and we are a consortium of 27 different ethnic museums, cultural centers, and historical societies in the Chicago metropolitan area. We are also partnered with 13 different institutions and small to mid-sized organizations as well. So maybe if we go to the first slide, our mission is to affect social change and public understanding through first voice perspective. And that's actually one of the reasons that digital technology is really important to us, is that we're working with our members to get their community's voices connected to larger discussions that are happening in Chicago and the region and the nation. And we do that through these museum collections. It's really interesting to me to be here today. About 3 weeks ago, I was in Seattle at the Society for Applied Anthropology meetings, and we were presenting at a session about participatory museums, really bringing museums outside of the traditional walls. And I would say about a third to half of this double session that we did on participatory museums had something to do with technology and how to connect your collections with things that are happening outside of your institution. You could go to the second slide. Again, this is about connecting our voices to what is happening in Chicago, our vision. And we do a lot of this work not only with cross-cultural work with our communities, but also by working with our partner institutions, which I believe is the next slide. I'm going to just give you a little bit of background on the Alliance so you can situate sort of what we're talking about and understand we have a couple of terms that we use. And I realize that not everybody knows what I'm talking about if I don't take the time to define them. So partner institutions are these larger cultural institutions in the Chicago area. For this, the purposes of this discussion, our main partners in our digitizing and museum collections work are the Chicago History Museum and the Field Museum. Their conservators, archivists, and registrars have played a really important role in the work that we are doing right now. We have associate members, which are the mid-sized organizations, and then probably our most important group, the core of the Alliance, are our core members, which is the next slide. There are 27 of them right now. We started out, we were incorporated in 2006 with 20 members. We've grown to 27. That's actually an addition of 8, and we lost 2 core members, mostly because of the economic climate. And this is our distribution on the next slide of how, I don't have percentages up there, but to give you a visual representation of how this reflects Chicago's communities, this is just by numbers of core members and not of sort of percentages of people that are engaged in these institutions. So core members are community-based, ethnic museums, cultural centers, and historical societies. They are really more than, you know, a social service agency that runs cultural programs or a museum. They're touchstones of ethnic identity. They're places that people go to when they want to reconnect with their community oftentimes. They are also places where communities go to gather, have community discussions, and we are actually working on a series where we're talking about contemporary issues in the context of these museums. So using the past and past experiences to talk about present conditions, especially around issues like immigration and migration, which is obviously an important issue for our community groups in Chicago, given that most of them are coming from outside of the United States. So I'll tell you a little bit about core member collections to situate why they are important in digitizing and connecting them with this idea of democracy and people taking ownership of what is happening online. Individually, our core member collections tell the story of their individual communities, right? But when we look at the Alliance, one of the great powers of it is that it's bringing people together and we're telling the story of Chicago. And it's a different story than the Chicago History Museum can tell, where they're telling the story primarily from a position of power, where these are the communities that have been living the experiences. You talk to the Lithuanian Museum, they'll talk about their communities' experiences in the stockyards. You talk to the Ethiopian Community Association, which is one of our newer members, and they have a collection of artifacts that they are connecting to their community's migration to Chicago most recently in the 1990s and early 2000s. We have a real variety of our core members, and that's reflected in our collection. So everybody has some sort of collection. It ranges from a couple of hundred pieces to over hundreds of thousands of pieces. There are, you know, I was saying this tells a story of Chicago, but it also tells a story beyond Chicago. A place like the Polish Museum of America has the most complete archive of Polish newspapers in the world because of the devastation wrought in World War II in Poland, where they were also collecting these papers here, and they were saved in archive. We have a wide variety of items, so newspapers, lots of ephemera, things that are really important for researchers, but it's hard for researchers to have access to because they, the more, you know, anybody that works with archives, the more you handle it, the more damage there is going to be, and we need to figure out a way to save some of this and bring greater access to these really unique collections. They're really personal collections as well for any of these organizations because they're donated by community members. And so it might be something that your grandmother or mother or great-grandmother brought to Chicago, or it may be something, as we're working with them now, to collect contemporary stories. So it might be your own story that's going into this archive through various donations you might make. And they're maintained with very, very few resources. So some of our groups have, they're all volunteers. They have budgets of $3,000 to $5,000. Collections are in people's basements. And then we have collections that are huge and partially cataloged. Nobody's fully cataloged and housed in more appropriate conditions. So the reason, one of the reasons that digitizing collections has become really important to us is that we've had sort of two different events. One is the Chinese American Museum of Chicago, which is located appropriately in Chinatown. In 2008, in the summer of 2008, they joined the Alliance. 2 months later, there was a devastating fire, and almost all of their collection was housed in the museum and was destroyed. There was some of the collection in a storage facility because the museum was undergoing renovation, but a huge percentage of their collection was destroyed, and these are things that can't be replicated. They're adoption certificates, they're you know, the trunks filled with items that family members brought over when they immigrated to Chicago, and this was really devastating. One of the amazing things about the fire was to see how our communities came together, even for this new member, came down, went through all of the materials, salvaged what we could, and we worked very closely with the History Museum and the Field Museum to do that work. The other piece that's important when I start talking about our digitizing program, which is just in process now, is that we have worked with one partner who's no longer a partner. We brought them on because we knew there was interest in digitizing collections. It was called Snapshot Chicago. I don't know if anybody's familiar with them. They are an online archive of photos where you can scan photos or upload digital photos, and they are organized in different ways, usually by organization that uploads them or ethnicity. Our members were really excited about this at first, but then realized they didn't have the training, the tools to do this. And so while that was a great experiment for us, it just wasn't sustainable. So we'll, if we go to the next slide, we have started what we're calling our conservation and collections program. We run four different sort of program types. The first one and most developed is capacity building, and this falls into our capacity building work. And in this, we also have some direct service. So to prepare for digitizing, we were funded by the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, who they found funding the Alliance was more effective than funding these individual organizations because we were able to pool resources, buy equipment that can be shared. Again, there's a lot of trust that's built up in the Alliance, and the sharing of resources for these very small institutions helps to connect these voices to these larger initiatives. So we're doing, we've done assessments, we're doing trainings, and we're doing workshops. I say eight workshops here, but actually in the course of those 2 years, we've done five workshops here. I said we've done eight hands-on workshops to help them professionalize their work with their collections, and we're building conservation kits in a library. The Donnelly Foundation has committed quite a bit more funding for the next 2 years to work on digitizing. So if we go to the next slide, again, we are sort of working with our members to prioritize their collections. This is not an issue for, you know, the organizations that have 300 items, but for the organizations that have hundreds of thousands, we need to figure out what we need to digitize first, what's the most urgent. So here's our digitizing. We are in the process of hiring a shared registrar that will go along to the different participating core members. There'll be 12 this year. We'll expand that to 14 core members next year, and actually doing registration and cataloging of items in an organized and consistent fashion. And then in 2012, we'll be hiring somebody to actually go through and start the digitization work. What we are trying to do, again, is take the steps so that this is done in a fairly organized way. If you go to the next slide, we have what we're looking at for our digital archive. Right now, the Alliance website has several different features, and I'm going to just touch on those at the close to give you some context to some of the other digital work that we're doing in our communities. But the archive is really thinking about this being a portal of entry to many of these museums that wouldn't be accessible to people, or somebody might not think of even going there and know that they exist. So getting their collections out to people. Also, we want to start organizing these collections beyond ethnicity. So you go to the Polish Museum or the Ukrainian Museum or the Bronzeville Historical Society because you're looking for something from that specific ethnic group. But what we really want to do is also tell the story of Chicago and think about a way to organize these in a different way. So you might go in and you might be doing environmental work in Chicago and want to find some connection to environmental history in a certain region of the city or neighborhood or you know, sort of at a certain time period, and we'll be able to compare. Part of this too will be asking people to upload and tell their stories of today. So photos of what's happening today, right, is history tomorrow, and starting to collect that instead of having these gaps in our members' collections, which often happens. And helping people to feel really connected to these museums and their missions. which is important for our museums to maintain their relevance as they age. So that's our archive. I want to talk really briefly about two or three different things we're also doing with digital technology. Last year we worked with the Field Museum. They hosted a photography exhibit that was exploring ethnic identity. It was called Kip Fulbeck, Part Asian, 100% Hapa. And it was a series of photographs of people that were of Asian descent, but also they were either mixed Asian descent or Asian and several other ethnicities. And people would answer the question, what are you? We worked with the Field Museum to install their first social media installation in-house. It was really scary for them as a big museum to think of letting go of control. And I'll say it was difficult. It wasn't as successful as we had hoped. But I think the museum has learned a lot from that. And so I'm hoping that we'll see a lot more interaction at the Field Museum. And this is one of the ways that small museums can help big museums experiment, because we're able to maneuver a little bit differently. We also have a lot of social media training that we do with our members. We've done helped them to set up Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts, and now we're doing strategy sessions with them so that we're talking about more than just events, but actually, okay, this here's a news article of what's happening in my community, let's talk about it, or here's a story of somebody that happened, something that happened in my community. Getting those stories out from the perspective of the people that are actually experiencing them using social media. And then we have a fairly interactive website for our members where we have forums where they can discuss challenges that they're having, resource sharing. We archive all of our materials from these conservation and collections workshops, from any of our other workshops, so they presentations, templates go up, they can be downloaded and used right on site at the member organizations when we're talking about policies and press releases and all of that great stuff that nonprofits need. And we have a volunteer matching program that's electronically managed. And the last thing that I wanted to talk about is that we've just started to work with Chicago Public Media on actually them joining the Alliance as a partner and starting to build digital story archives for our members. That's one of the ultimate goals for us in that partnership. So thank you very much. I know that's sort of a lot at the end there, but it was a pleasure to speak with you today.
I mean, that's been a huge part of this, and I'm passing out a sheet right now. Champaign-Urbana is a college town. I mean, and one of the things that this is the table that I'm showing you is just in the last 2 years there's been at least 80 different projects coming out of the University of Illinois, working in some capacity with the African American community, which is a community of only about 17,000 people. So connecting the dots is a huge and ongoing issue, and I'm not sure if we really have the answer, but at least we've identified the problem, and I think the only concrete steps that we've taken so far, we had a campus community symposium last November where we had a shuttle going between a historically African American church and the Graduate School of Library and Information Science operating all day, And a lot of people took advantage of this shuttle because they didn't want to drive to campus. They didn't want to park on campus, but they were willing to park in this church parking lot and let us drive them to campus. So I just thinking of innovative, strategic ways to break down boundaries is key. We also released a book. There's documentation of most of those 80 projects. If out in the Cardinal Room, the registration room, we released a book called Community Engagement at the University of Illinois is another way to, at the very least, start to centralize the documentation and try to think about how we can create some kind of culture of accountability through documentation and records keeping and archives. So we definitely, even though we're really interested in cultural heritage, we haven't lost sight of the mission of accountability, which is kind of hardwired in the notion of archives and archiving.
Thank you. Yes.
Just to briefly follow up on that and also ask a question.
Can you use that mic? Thank you.
Just to briefly follow up on your point, whenever I travel around the country, I always make sure to stop at the local university to see what projects the students have done in that local area. And I was in South Carolina just recently and went to one of the universities there, and they had actually done an archaeological project on one of the plantations where the slaves lived in that particular area. And you know, you think about anthropology, but then, you know, they also had a lot of historical pieces that added on to that. So you're absolutely right. Many of these universities have done a lot of good work on the local communities of which they exist. My question is, you mentioned an open source software called Omeka. Could you explain what that software does?
Yeah, certainly. So basically, Omeka is a content management system. It's software that you can download. And if you have a URL that you've purchased, Mr. Burroughs has tonyburroughs.com. So if you have a URL in a server space, you can then download the software to your server. And it'll just install itself on your server, and then it's kind of like it's similar to WordPress. If any of you have used WordPress or software like that, where after you've downloaded and installed the software, then you just use the graphical interface to manage all your items. You can add all your description, all your cataloging records. Your metadata is all done through graphical interfaces. In other words, I don't think that computer is connected to the internet. Otherwise, I'd walk you through it. But it's not enormously difficult. And I'd be happy to send to you or to anyone who's interested a copy of the manual that we're putting together when it's ready. That's going to spell out in more detail how it works. But Omeka has really taken off. Like, it was just started by George Mason University just, I think, a little over a year ago. We were one of the, but it's already been adopted by, I think they just announced on their blog that 1,000 institutions across the world have already kind of picked up on this as a great asset. And it's used both by large institutions and small institutions, even just individuals. Like, there's this one individual who's really into firefighters, so he created this digital library on firefighters just in his spare time using Omeka. So it's really powerful, and I'd be happy to try to tell you more about it after the session.
Rebecca, but I'm kind of curious. I was interested in that digitizing issue, and it's rather a futuristic question, but is it possible to think that you can digitize, you know, the whole museum, and that you can emulate, like in the future, the visit to the museum itself? And in a sense that, well, maybe the person doesn't have to visit the museum anymore, which is maybe not bad, but also, you know, you don't have to worry about, like, the museum going down, like, African American thing, but is it possible to emulate that experience all the way just via, you know, digital?
So I think that's a great question, and I'll answer sort of in two different ways. I think I could see in the future that you could have sort of this digital museum that's not, I mean, when we think about digitizing collections and having this online archive, we want to make it as exciting as possible, but it's not going to be like walking into the museum, right? It's going to be like, okay, sort for these items, and hopefully it'll look cool and be really interactive, but it's not going to be a museum visit. But I think you could sort of do a virtual visit to a museum, and there's value in that, and that doesn't cancel out the value of having the actual museum, because the actual museum is where a lot of the interaction is going to take place, where you have somebody maybe that lived this experience that is documented in the museum guiding you through it. And I think that's one of the really great values of our core members, is that these are personal stories, and the people that are working there are connected to these stories, so they can give you a different experience than maybe you get virtually. But then I want to mention one of our core members, which is a really young organization, even younger than the Alliance, the Indo-American Heritage Museum. And they consider themselves a virtual museum. They don't have a space at all. They borrow space from the Indo-American Center, which is a social service organization. They have a small meeting room there where they'll greet people and do some programming. And they use two different tools for their museum. They use Devon Avenue and bring people out and actually do tours and use the stores and the restaurants and the groceries as the living museum. And then they have an online portal that they're building to document stories and photographs and materials.
There are indeed a number of virtual museums out there on the internet that have no physical presence whatsoever. So just phrase searching that virtual museum, I think you'd be surprised at the sheer number.
I know
one of the projects is to add to that a little bit of a different angle. One of the projects we're working on in partnership with the School of Ed at Michigan is looking at ways we can use like iPhone technology. So bringing, you know, classrooms to the museum and letting the kids take pictures as part of a project that they then bring back to the classroom and are able to, you know, continue to explore materials after they've left.
Questions for?
Yes. Got pretty four unique institutions here, but I was kind of curious as to the funding that makes your guys' digitization projects possible.
So I'll just start. Our funding is primarily right now through the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. They fund local history initiatives in Chicago and actually South Carolina. And they view this collectively as a significant contribution to the sort of Chicago history that they want to fund us. We are, as we grow the digitization process beyond sort of next year and the experimental phase, we're hoping to go after NEH funding primarily, but of course that's going to depend on what happens with budgets in Washington, as I'm sure everybody knows.
Yeah, we've primarily been funded by the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation as well. They've been our biggest funder over the last several years. But we've also gotten project grants from the NHPRC, which is the grant making wing of the National Archives, and the NEH, as well as other smaller ones.
For us, we're not really at the digitization point yet. First, we have to kind of get our house in order, and we are actively pursuing funding, including the Donnelly Foundation. We have received a grant for a Project Archivist, who will hopefully draw, you know, a game plan here. But we do have grants and letters of intent out to other funding organizations.
And I mentioned that we got our funding internally from a university grant, but I just wanted to mention the person who asked that question is Frank Murray, who's one of our resource people from Evergreen Public Library, and if I'm correct, both Mr. Murray and Ms. Chapman got a small grant from the State Historical Records Advisory Board, which is something administered through the Illinois State Archives. And it's a really good re-granting program that hope, I mean, the grant cycle just ended, but there'll probably be another grant cycle next year if we cross our fingers. So there's a number of opportunities out of Springfield, and as well as the Illinois Humanities Council and the Illinois State Museum, Illinois Association of Museums occasionally do small grants that can help small institutions.
Actually, I just wanted to add too, because we are a different model, and if anybody's thinking of working as a consortium, one of the things that we do with all of our projects, but primarily with this one, is that while the Alliance is paying for a good chunk of what's happening, our members are expected to bring resources and contribute. And for us, that's a way of also helping them build their capacities, having them to start to carve out resources at their institutions to do this kind of work.